Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on BBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at publicityworksagency.com. And remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Straubs are Britain's most successful international progressive folk rock band. They are mentioned in the same breath as progressive rock bands as Yes, King Crimson, and the Moody Blues. Straubs have a devoted fan base that continues to grow on the strength of their incredible live performances, together with their classic albums over the years, including Grave New World, Bursting at the Seams, Hero and Heroine, and Ghosts. The band has achieved sales of over 3 million albums. Seven consecutive Straub albums have featured in the U.S. Billboard Top 200 albums. Many top musicians have been featured in the Straubs lineup over the years, including Sonia Christina, who has been on the show, Blue Weaver, Don Airey, and as well as Rick Wakeman. Both his classically trained sons, Adam and Oliver, have been featured, a certain complement to the band's talent. After several years of touring in both acoustic and electric lineups, in 2017, Straubs released The Pheromone's Curse, their first studio album of original material in over 8 years. The album returned to the album charts and garnered rave reviews worldwide. The current Straubs lineup comprises David Cousins, Dave Lampert, Chaz Kronk, and drummer Tony Fernandez, who recorded and toured together in the 1970s. They are joined by keyboard and guitar virtuoso Dave Bainbridge of Iona, a band who created a mystical blend of rock, folk, Celtic, and ambient music, a perfect match for Straubs. British rock legend Straubs will mark their 50th anniversary with a three-day event filled with exclusive musical performances that feature the band's current lineup, special guests, and many of the artists that have contributed to the band's sound over its five-decade history. The event will take place at the Strand Theater in Lakewood, New Jersey from April 26th through April 28th, and will be hosted by Straubs' founding member David Cousins, along with long-serving bandmates Chaz Kronk, Dave Lampert, Tony Fernandez, and the band's latest addition, Dave Bainbridge. Featuring special guests, Tony Visconti, our friend Annie Haslam, Larry Fast, and others. You can visit www.straubs50.com for more information. Please welcome English singer, songwriter, and guitarist who has been the leader, singer, and most active songwriter of the Straubs since 1967, Dave Cousins, to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Dave.
Hi.
Well, there's a lot more. I mean, you guys go way back, so it's hard to fit it all in.
Yeah, you're telling me. I look back and wonder where all the time's gone.
Goes by fast, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Well, it's going faster every day.
Every day, I know. I'm in the same boat.
As we get closer to our 50th anniversary, my gosh, that's going to be some celebration.
Well, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Let's first talk about this incredible upcoming music event. I guess you were one of the main people that put this thing together. How did you come about picking 3 days in New Jersey for this event?
We've been friends with the mayor of Lakewood, New Jersey, the seven times mayor, Ray Coles, for a long, long time. In fact, about 10 years ago, he gave us a mayoral citation on one of his first stints as the mayor. And we've remained very close friends ever since. Lakewood, New Jersey is just about an hour and a half from Manhattan and about an hour from Newark Airport. So it's quite conveniently located. It's on the Jersey shoreline, and Bruce Springsteen lives about 20 minutes down the road.
Oh, how about that?
Who knows?
Yeah, who knows? It's going to be a great event.
I'll say no more.
Who knows, huh?
Yeah,
there's a lot of special guests that are going to be there. Of course, Tony Visconti, which has been very instrumental.
Well, Tony Visconti did the arrangement
right. For
our very first draw single that was released back in 1968. And he's rewriting the score for the event. He's coming to conduct the orchestra for it. He'll also be conducting the orchestra for a song written by Annie Haslam. Sandy Denny's immortal, who knows where the time goes.
Yeah.
Because Sandy Denny at one time was a member of the Strokes, believe it or not.
Yeah, she was incredible too, back in her day. And
she was a stunning lady.
Yeah. And Annie Haslam, who's a friend of mine, I love Annie. I've interviewed her many, many times and had many conversations with her. She's always a tremendous addition when you can get her in the band.
Well, I'm hoping to see her next week. I'm going to New York on Sunday.
Okay.
But at the moment, she's laid low with her chest cold. I'm sure she's going to be okay because I want her to join us because I'm going to the United Nations building on Tuesday to rehearse with the United Nations singers.
Really?
Who will be, I'm hoping, will join us as the climax of this whole mega event that we're putting on. It's a 40-piece multicultural choir, and they all wear their home country's dresses or suits or clothing, and it'll be a very colourful spectacular, and I believe it'll finish the whole thing off with a magnificent bang.
I had no idea they had singers from the United Nations. That's new to me.
It's a thing that they put together 40 odd years ago. No, longer than that. But anyway, it's made up of people who work for the United Nations
right.
in New York and surrounding area. So they're members. They might work for UNICEF. They might work for UNFPA. But they all get together and their recreation is singing together. But they give concerts when special dignitaries come to the United Nations building. They give concerts for them. They've got a choir master. They're extremely professional. And I'm looking forward to meeting up with them. And they've already said they want to come. And I'm very, very excited about it.
Are they only singers or do they have like an orchestra as well?
No, we have a 30-piece orchestra event as well. At our weekend anniversary celebration. But that will be on the orchestra will be playing on the Friday night, and I'm hoping the United Nations singers will close the Saturday night.
That's incredible. Now, are you guys going to tape this for maybe, you know, like video or anything like that?
We're taping it.
Okay.
Whether we're going to video it or not, I'm not absolutely sure. The trouble is that nowadays, DVD players are not being made anymore because everybody's going into streaming. And also, the cost of editing this whole program is something like going to be 8 hours of performances.
Right.
And that's a heck of a lot of stuff left to edit. And so it's overwhelming both in the volume of what we've got to do and overwhelming in terms of the cost. But we're waiting to see about that. My friend Larry Fast is talking next week to a public broadcasting company, so I can't say any more than that at the moment.
Yeah, Larry's been with Nectar, Synergy. I used to love Synergy. I was one of the first ones to even buy a Synergy's album. And, of course, Peter Gabriel.
I'd go back with Larry Fast to an album called The Intergalactic Touring Band.
Wow.
Which was made in 1978.
Uh-huh.
And I was very delighted to be able to sing one of the songs on it. And I've remained in touch with Larry ever since. And I saw him just before Christmas, a couple of weeks before Christmas, went to his house out in the countryside in New Jersey. And we sat and talked all day about the songs we're going to do. And we're going to do really obscure, short material. Some of the songs have never ever been played on stage before.
Really?
But we're conversing by phone. I went and sat and talked to him about how I thought the song should be done. I'd listen to the recordings of the songs, and then we discussed the treatment that they give. And he's been on the phone and said he's got the basic framework of it worked out. He needs to know the keys, confirm the key that they're going to be in, and I can speed them up or slow them down if I want to. That's easy enough.
Right.
But I'm hoping to see him either next week, or I'll have to go back to New York about a couple of weeks after that just to rehearse with him. This whole thing is a very adventurous thing to do, to rehearse 3,000 miles apart. It's quite difficult.
Well, but it's done a lot these days.
Yeah, I know. Not for a major concert.
No. You're right about that.
People may send audio files right to one another, but not rehearsing for a live stage performance.
No, that's pretty difficult. You got, I'm assuming Rick Wakeman is going to be there.
No, unfortunately, Rick's had to withdraw. He's got a serious illness in the family.
That's a shame.
He just can't make it. He's very, very sad about not being able to.
Yeah.
However, Blue Weaver is confirmed as appearing.
Okay.
Blue Weaver, as you know, left the Strolls to join the Bee Gees band.
That's right.
And he played on Saturday Night Fever and all those other monster records that the Bee Gees had in the 1970s. He was with them for 8 years. He wrote some of the songs with the Gibb Brothers, and he's an extraordinarily talented musician. I travelled to Germany, where he lives now, to be with him a couple of weeks ago, and we spent 3 or 4 days going through the Brave New World album, because we're going to do the whole of the Brave New World album performed on stage live, and probably for the only time ever.
Wow, that's incredible. It's a shame, though. It'd be a shame. I know it's expensive and everything, but it'd be a shame not to have that. I'd love to have that in my collection.
Well, I think we'll film it in some way or another, don't worry.
Well, at least there should be a CD or something coming out, right? Eventually.
I hope so, yeah. The other person who's playing in the Great New World lineup is Eric Bazillion of the Hooters. He's joining us to play guitar and sing with us.
Right.
I met up with him 2 years ago and played with him live in one of the Cabinet of Wonders at City Winery in New York. We got on famously. He now lives in Stockholm, so I've got to travel to Stockholm in Sweden now.
Wow.
Well, to go and rehearse with him.
Eric played,
I'm an international jet setter these days.
Yes, you are. Eric played with the Hooters, I think, and I think some with Joan Osborne. He was involved with those guys, I think.
Yeah, Joan Osborne, he wrote What If God Was One of Us for Joan Osborne and produced the record. And he's going to sing that particular song himself with our 30-piece orchestra at our special event.
It's going to be a hell of an event, man.
Well, somebody else is turning up to sing one of my songs. And to sing her own monster hit is Sophie B. Hawkins.
Oh, wow. Really?
She's coming to sing Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover.
Uh-huh.
But also she's singing one of my songs called Burning For Me as a tribute to the Strokes.
Oh, that would be awesome.
That's extraordinary, isn't it? You've got a much younger singer who appreciates and admires Strokes music and wants to join in the celebration.
That's incredible. You know, Burning For Me is in my top 10 of all time song collection. To me, that song's the best Straub song ever. I love that song. It is so intelligent. And, the lyrics are beautiful. The music is beautiful. I love that song.
Yeah, in a studio in Holland,
right,
in the Netherlands, in a very bleak, bleak landscape all around it, totally isolated. And we needed a song, and the producer, Jeffrey Lesser, said, "Oh, go next door and write a song." About 10 minutes later, I came back with it. It was one of those very quick songs.
That's incredible.
I came up with a piano figure, and they put the lyrics to it straight away, and we recorded it about an hour later, and it remained one of the favorites that we do.
What were you thinking about when you wrote that song? I mean, you know, how did that all come about?
I was with my then fiance, who was pregnant at the time, with my eldest son, and she was pining to be home in the West Country in England, and so I wrote the song for her.
Oh.
In fact, there's something which people don't possibly realize about stored material, is that all of the songs are essentially either autobiographical or written about places where we've been,
right,
or written about people that we know. People identify with the lyrics of the songs, and they mean something very, very personal to them, and they are intensely personal when they're written, but people in their interpretation of them make them very personal for themselves as well.
Well,
and I think that's been the reason,
yep,
for our longevity over the years.
The songs are very visual too, you know, they're all stories, you know, it's like reading a book, you know, pretty much.
Well, they are, they're yeah, my autobiography in,
yep,
song.
You know, the longevity of the Straubs is amazing because, you know, you guys have done, I mean, you started out, I guess, with a little bit of the bluegrass and maybe even Skittle music, right? Way, 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 way back. Skiffle?
Yeah.
Yeah, and then, you know, you could classify you guys as prog, they're goth, you know, there's so many different elements to the band, you know, and
yes, but we've never deliberately set out to make an album. Oh, we'll make a prog album now.
Right.
Oh, we'll make a gothic album now. Never. Everything that we've ever done has evolved due to people coming into the band. We changed from being a folk trio.
Right.
I decided when our acoustic bass player left, stand-up bass player left, I thought, well, we need an electric bass now, so I recruited John Ford, then they brought his drummer into the band, suddenly we had two acoustic guitars and drums and bass. It didn't really work. I thought, well, we need a keyboard player now.
Right.
So I invited Rick Wakeman to join the band. He was with us for 2 years. Then he left us to join Yes. Then Blue Weaver joined. He left us to join the Bee Gees and went on to fame and fortune. John Hawkin came along and played on Hero and Heroin and Ghosts.
Yep.
And he knew nothing whatsoever about mellotrons and synthesizers. But he put a whole different perspective on the way, because he was piano playing, he put a whole different perspective on playing our music. And so he left us. We then had two keyboard players, our arranger, Robert Kirby, who did the Nick Drake albums and became very famous as an arranger, and a guy called John Meeling from Bangle Riff. They left. So then I brought in Adam Wakeman, Rick's second eldest son.
Right.
And then later on, his brother, Oliver Wakeman, joined the band. Oliver, like his dad, left us to join Yes. What an extraordinary coincidence. But I'm the only band leader in the whole wide world that's ever had all three Wakeman playing in the band.
Boy, that's some talented family, I can tell you that.
It certainly is.
Yeah. You know, the Straubs have been so, you know, like you said, you got your own crowd, you know, for all these years, and especially in America, you know, the Straubs really, thrived in America, which was, you know, really cool because, you know, there's a lot of bands that don't come to America, and they're very big in Europe, but they don't come here that much. One band in particular was Status Quo. You know, they stayed over there in Europe. They never came back over here. But the Straubs were very successful here.
We had two careers.
Yep.
Because we had, with Blue Reaver, when we had huge hit singles in the UK.
Yep.
Number one single, another top ten single with Part of the Union and Lay Down, respectively.
Yeah.
And then when Blue left, we evolved with John Hawking coming in into being more of a prog band. But our audience deserted us when Part of the Union, which they regarded as being a novelty song, went to number one in the charts.
Right.
And they deserted us in the UK. We then went and worked in North America, the USA and Canada, for about 6 years, and we hardly ever came home. And suddenly we had huge records in America. Ghosts went to the highest position in the charts around the 40s. But Hero and Heroin still selling very, very well. It's God knows how many records it sold. Unfortunately, A&M decided to sell up to Polydor, and then that became Universal, and the records are all being lost, so we've got no idea how many records we ever have sold altogether. I know you said 3 million earlier. It's certainly 4 million.
Yeah.
And we still continue to sell lots of records. But we were very lucky in having a big career in the UK and having a big career in the USA and Canada.
Well, the big thing, too, is you guys got to play the music you wanted to play. You didn't really have to kind of sell out for commercial-wise, which was probably very important to the band.
We've only ever recorded, two songs, I believe, that weren't written by members of the band.
Mm-hmm.
One was, we had to record that when we made an album for Virgin in Canada, and because of Canadian content, we had to record a Canadian song. But that's one of the only ones we've done. We've never done anything deliberately to we wanted to have hit singles. I'm not being precious about it, but we never set out to do it.
I talked to the guys from you remember Dr. Hook in the Medicine Show?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, they had a period where they were low on money. So when the disco period came, they had to, they had to do a lot of commercial stuff, and they made a lot of money doing it, but it wasn't really their style, But
yeah,
that's the only way. It was tough to survive back then during the disco period, But
well, I got to know the pair of them, Dennis and Ray Sawyer.
Yeah.
And they told me a very funny story that they were playing in Copenhagen
in
Denmark.
Uh-huh.
And they looked out at the audience, and the audience were virtually stripped off completely. So the band decided to strip off. And Dennis LeCorrier said, well, it was fine for me because I had a guitar so I could cover myself up. And Ray saw it. Ray saw it. He said, well, it was all right for you, but I only had a tambourine.
Dennis is a funny guy.
They're great characters.
Oh, yeah. Dennis is real funny. He did a... radio promo for me that was hilarious. He's a good guy. We just lost Ray not long ago, which is a shame.
I know, it's very sad.
Yeah. Well, you got more dates coming up, but I got a feeling you guys are going to have a lot more dates in 2019. I know you got in April, you're going to be in Vienna, Virginia, in the 17th in Rochester, and I know you'll be back in Pennsylvania, Sellersville, back in on the 20th. Are you going to be adding additional dates as you go along?
We are. At the moment, because I'm so concentrating so much on the 50th, I haven't been pushing our agents to get more gigs in. I'm setting up some gigs in, believe it or not, in Norway in November, which is not exactly the best time to tour in Norway. Not the best place to tour in Norway. I'm setting that up at the moment. I'm working with an agent on bringing us together, back together, in the new year, the year after.
Okay.
And I really would love to do Rozfest again. We did it in Gettysburg with Dave Bainbridge. It was the first time we recorded with him, and we put a live album out of that.
Yeah, I saw that.
Live in Gettysburg. Abraham Lincoln said he was going to come, but unfortunately he couldn't make it. Which was a great show. So we put this picture on the cover, to welcome him.
I used to visit Gettysburg as a kid. I'm originally from the Washington, D.C. area. But where did you play in Gettysburg?
In the Majestic Theater.
Oh, okay. That was a cool place.
It was a lovely, lovely town to go to. But we didn't get much time to spend there. We just had a little walk around the center, and then we were on stage.
That's a cool place to visit. You got to go back. Yeah.
I'd love to, yeah.
I want to talk about the Pharaoh's Curse. That's your most recent album. I gave it 5 stars, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
It's an incredible album. It's so good that, you know, after all these years, to put a new album out and you can say, wow, you know, it blew me away. I thought it was a great album. Lots of favorites on this. I love the Nails from the Hands of Christ. Kind of had like a Pink Floyd beat to it in the beginning, which was really, really cool. The familiar
reference to Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, the reference to Bruce Springsteen. Now you got a lot of religious overtones in this, which you have, I guess, in past albums.
Well, there have been. Save Me World was a very spiritual album.
Right.
It doesn't mean to say that I'm a religious fanatic. I don't go around preaching. But I'm in my upstairs room at the moment, looking out over a church built in 1135.
Right.
A magnificent old church. And at night, and they've still left the cross on the top of the tower.
Right.
Illuminated at night. And I just look out at it, and I go, wow, and it's very impressive. And I go into that church and look up at the Norman ceiling, and it's just unbelievable to look at. But I love the atmosphere of churches. I always have done. I love going around historic buildings. And again, that has had a great influence on the way I write songs. Curiously, I woke up this morning with a song in my head. And it's a chord sequence I have no idea how to play. But I actually got up and got the mobile phone out and pressed the button and recorded the tune. God knows what it'll sound like. I play it back. It'll sound dreadful. I was pretty tired at 7:30 this morning. But I just had this nagging tune in my head. What I hope is that it's not something I've picked up from somewhere. And absorbed. I don't think I have. I just think it's an original sequence. It's just cutting to me. But that's what happens. And people say, do you write the lyrics first or do you write the music first? I never know. I can't tell. Sometimes it's the lyrics that come first.
Mm-hmm.
In particular, the Nails from the Hands of Christ. The lyrics, not all the lyrics came first, but the first couple of verses and the idea of it came first. And then I got together with Chas Kronk, our bass player, and we sat down, and suddenly there it was. It just came out spontaneously. And the bass line, we were up at Dave Bainbridge's studio, which is about 250 miles away from where I live.
Wow.
And we putting it down, and Chas started to play the bass. And I just suddenly heard this bass line and said, no, it needs to be simple like this. And suddenly it had a groove to it, and it was wonderful. And we've kept that feeling. Now it's magnificent on stage to play.
I love the album. Ten Commandments, another very cool melody. Kind of has a feel of like Dire Straits or Eric Clapton vibe to it, you know?
Yeah, that's one of Dave Lambert's songs. It's one of his classic songs, actually. It's again a slight spiritual overtone.
Yep.
But if you look at the lyrics carefully, it's about a review of all the new religions.
Exactly. Yeah.
Religions, but he's comparing it with being of David Beckham and Posh Spice, with them being worshipped, and they're worshipped as much as God is these days. And so it's a slightly cynical approach to it.
Yeah.
But I put that after the Ferryman's Curse itself. I put it after what was it? Oh, it's gone out of my mind now.
Well, you had Ten Commandments, the and then you had the Reckoning.
Comes on to when the Spirit moves.
Right.
Because that is very spiritual.
Right.
And I thought, well, I'll throw in a contrast in the running order to give the album more, you know, make people think even more.
And the Theremin's Curse, that's a kind of a strange track, isn't it? You know, I like the drum roll in the beginning of it. I wish they kept the drum roll throughout the song, because that was pretty cool in the background. But talk about the Theremin's Curse.
The Theremin's Curse is a sequel to a song called The Vision of the Lady in the Lake, which was on our
right.
second album, Dragonfly.
Okay.
We recorded in 1969.
Wow.
So it's taken me over 45 years to write the sequel. But again, I've been thinking about writing the sequel for a long time.
Right.
And now my next bright idea is to produce a script and a synopsis of a Game of Thrones type series for TV. Because I think the whole idea of the ferryman, and you don't know, he lives maybe in Hades, who knows? And his wife, the whole key to it is that in one of the very last lines, where his wife sits up in bed,
right.
bares her pointed teeth and smiles. Now that is very sinister.
It is sinister.
And so that sets the sequel for the next one. I've got to write another one now.
Yeah. Kind of, I was thinking about the White Walkers from Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
Are you a big Game of Thrones fan?
No, I've never watched one. I've read a book by the guy who wrote it, a novel, which is very sinister.
Yep.
But I'm not a great TV viewer.
I don't get time. Yeah, no, there's no way. The final season is this April, you know,
They'll all be killed.
Yeah, I think there's got to be one, somebody's got to be left to, you know, rule.
there'll be a plague of rats.
A plague of rats? Or the White Walkers
they'll
will take
die.
Over.
They'll die.
I like We Have the Power, too. It's got a kind of a hallelujah background sound, you know, too. It's very spiritual as well.
That's the song that I'm going to the United Nations to
rehearse. Oh, really? That's it, huh?
Because to rehearse that with a choir, the choir singing We Have the Power within us and me singing to those mountains if we try. Then they sing to change the course of rivers or the color of the sky. Whether I can pull it off or not, I don't know. I just hope so.
I think you will. It's an incredible song. Love the album. Love the album. It's a great album. You guys should be very proud of it.
We are. It was recorded 18 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
I was very ill while we were doing it. I had terrible problems with my kidneys.
Really?
I've only got one kidney that works anyway. But I had terrible problems with it, with a huge stone in it that had come adrift. And I was very seriously ill while recording the album. But when I was singing the vocals, to make it even worse, I suddenly developed a hernia. And so the singing was agony.
Oh,
I'm not exaggerating in the slightest. And 2 weeks after we finished the album, I had an operation to cure it.
Right.
I wish I'd had it before. But what it's done is liberated me somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that hernia, which my consultant put down to an operation I had when I was 12 years old, he said that that's been growing and building all this time.
Huh.
And I think it's inhibited my singing all these years.
Really?
Because now, since it's been repaired, I'm singing higher notes than I've ever sung in my life. I'm singing with more strength and more power than I've ever sung before.
How about that? That's amazing. That is amazing.
There's a little bit of medical history in the band as well.
Yeah. How did they cure the gallbladder, because I went through the same thing. When I wrote my book, I was
kidney,
sick.
Kidney stones.
Kidney stones, yeah.
I went into the hospital, and they had to put a nephrostomy tube in my size. And
oh,
I had
that
from February to June last year.
Yep.
Which was not agony, it was just incredibly uncomfortable.
Yeah.
But they were going to take the stone out through the kidney. In the end, they couldn't work way, so they'd had to go in. I've had three operations so far.
Uh-huh.
I had one just before Christmas in December. But that was to crush what was left of the stone.
Right.
And it's a horrible thing to say, but it's gradually coming out bit by bit. But I've got to go in, and I hope I'm going to go in before I come over for the 50th, to get the rest of it out, because then I'm feeling much, much better than I have done for years, because all of our medical problems have been being sorted out.
Very good. It's not completely gone, but it's almost gone, the stone.
Correct.
Yeah. Well, we wish you the best on that.
Well, I was just on a cruise going around the Bahamas with Michael Harlem, Steve Hackett, Justin Hayward, the River Fudge, the orchestra, all of these bands. And one morning I woke up and peed two lumps of kidney stone.
Oh, man.
One of which I managed to have kept as a souvenir. It's much bigger than you realize.
Yeah.
It's very sharp and very hard.
Jeez.
And I show it to people every now and then, they can't believe it. But it's gradually curing itself. Your listeners aren't going to want to hear all this.
Yeah, they do. They like to hear that you're human.
Oh, I'm not human. I'm superhuman.
I saw a YouTube video that you did, which was awesome. I really liked it. It's called In the Beginning, where you guys talk about the beginning of the straws, the early years, and I really, really, everyone needs to go see that, because it talks about when you guys started out, which was, I didn't know that you got the name from the Strawberry Hill House.
The Strawberry Hill, yeah.
Yeah, and that place.
It's an area of West London.
Right.
Called Strawberry Hill. And the house there is a beautiful Gothic mansion.
Oh, it's beautiful.
And we rehearsed in that area. Curiously, an apartment owned by a young lady, she was at the title, Susie Sharm.
Right.
Who was the daughter of a very famous American painter called Ben Sharm. And so we used to rehearse around at her apartment, and we got our first gig. And we didn't have a name, and I was playing bluegrass banjo, and I was into the scenes of the Foggy Mountain Boys, the Stony Mountain Boys, the Rocky Mountain Boys, and so on. So I said, well, we call ourselves the Strawberry Hill Boys. And so it stuck.
Then we
abbreviated it to Straubs.
I went on the website for the Strawberry Hill House. It's currently closed. Following, they had the Lost Treasures exhibit. I can't even say the word exhibit, but it'll be reopened in April for the spring season.
Yeah,
I was reading.
It was open all the last year with this very special exhibition of old furniture and paintings.
Right.
It's closed now, but it'll reopen to the tourist trade in the summer.
That's beautiful. It really is.
It's a glorious place.
Yeah. And I was watching the White Bear. I guess that's where you guys used to hang out, and you played there. And
The White Bear pub was at the end of my road in West London, in a part of it. It's called Hounslow.
Right.
And it's right under the flight path to Heathrow. And in the summer, I used to go out in the garden, lie on the grass and look up at the sky. And I'm not exaggerating. The planes used to come in so low that I could see the pilots in the cockpit.
That is pretty low.
It was very, they still come in that low. I saw the last flight that Concorde did come in.
Heathrow one day.
It was a beautiful thing to see.
What happened to the Concorde? It just went away, didn't it?
One of them caught fire in France.
Oh, really?
And they were costing so much to maintain that they sold them off to museums, broke them all up, and it's a tragedy. They were magnificent things.
Yeah.
There's not one flying even at air shows. But it was causing problems with supersonic bangs.
Right.
I lived in West London in a place called Teddington, not far from Strawberry Hill, about 20 years ago.
Right.
And every afternoon at 3 o'clock, Concorde used to fly over. Huh. And there was a bang as it went over the house.
Yeah, that's a shame. It was a good idea.
Bang, but it was the beginning of the supersonic.
Yeah.
And it kicked in.
Did you ever fly on one?
No, I walked through one in a museum.
You were talking about Rick. You were talking about Rick Wakeman. He used to go there and play, and then reading obscene poems. That sounds like Rick Wakeman. Did you see him at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? His speech with Yes.
I saw a bit. So yeah.
He was hilarious. I didn't know he was so funny.
No, that's part of his stage show. Seriously, he does shows where it's half comedian and half music.
Really?
They're very entertaining.
Yeah, he could definitely do stand-up.
Yeah.
You guys supported the Rolling Stones back in the day when they weren't...
Yeah, we did. When they were first starting up, it was extraordinary. Where they played was a place called the Yupai Island, the Yupai Hotel. And it's in the middle of the River Thames, midway between Hampton Court and central London.
Right.
And it's called the Yupai Island because that's where Henry VIII used to stop off to have an Yupai on the way home. And it had the first sprung dance floor in the country.
Right.
In Britain.
Huh.
In England. And when the Stones played there, the young guys used to get on one another's shoulders, three high.
Right.
Bounce up and down on this floor. You've never seen such mayhem in all your life. Tragically, there was a fire in the hotel and it burnt down.
Wow.
But I went over there, it must be 20 years ago now, maybe a little bit less, with Long John Baldry.
Yep.
And I walked out with him. We went and walked around and reminisced about the old days over there. And sadly, he went back to Canada, and about a month or so later, he died and passed away.
Wow, that's a shame.
So many memories.
Yeah, lots of memories. I got to ask you, on the hero and the heroine, what is that on the front cover?
It's a dove.
Oh, it's a dove. I couldn't make it out for some reason.
Art director literally brought in a live dove.
Right.
And it dropped it.
Okay.
And they took a photograph, so it sort of tried to sort of flutter its wings and get away.
I had no idea all these years. I'm glad you cleared that up for me. I thought it was a jellyfish. It kind of looked like a jellyfish for some.
No, it's a dove. It pulled his hand on him. He's just bloody lucky he didn't sort of crap himself.
I want to plug your book as well. You publish an autobiography, Exercising Ghosts, Straubs, and Other Lies.
Yeah.
That came out, I think, in 2014. And I want to make sure everybody goes out and buys that. That's available on Amazon as well.
You can still get it on Amazon, I believe.
Yeah.
There's not too many copies left now.
Really?
Yeah, we only produced a hardback edition. I could have done a paperback, but I thought, no, I want a hardback book.
Did you write that on your own?
I wrote every word myself, longhand.
Right.
I typed it all up myself, I read it back to myself, and then edited it myself.
Wow.
Every word of that is me.
You know, I'm very excited about that.
18 months.
Very excited about that, because, you know, there's so many musicians and celebrities that, oh yeah, I wrote a book, and they didn't do anything, you know, and you're a true author.
Sit in front of a microphone and tell stories and have somebody else write it up.
Exactly. I'm an author myself, and I'm, you know, I think it's awesome that you did that.
Well, I did it myself. I wrote it, as I pencil and rubber longhand. I couldn't write at home, so I went away first of all to Barcelona in Spain for 10 days and started it. Then I went to another small town, Roses, in Spain, and did some 3 weeks there. I went so I, several places I did it. Suddenly it caught me unawares there. But it was, halfway through, I nearly gave up and said, this is getting too personal, I don't want to do this.
Right.
But in the end, I forced myself to finish it. And it all rounded itself up, and it tied a knot at the very end, and where it started and where it finished seemed to be to balance.
How long did it take you to finish it?
18 months.
18 months isn't bad. That's not bad at all. No, it took me 3 years to write mine, and I have another one coming out soon, and that's taking me even longer.
Wow.
Yeah.
When I got down to it, I just wrote it.
And you say you edited the book yourself too, huh?
Yeah, I then gave it to the guy who runs the Shaw's website.
Right.
He's a lawyer, and he went through and cut out some of the bits that I was going to lose my house for.
Well, I'm going to have to pick up, a copy before it all runs out.
Yeah, well, good, please do. The other one you should look out for is called Secret Stories and Songs.
Okay.
And it's the lyrics of all of my songs with an explanation of what they're really about.
Oh, great. Is that available too on Amazon, or...?
No, that's sold out now. We only produced 1,000 copies. It was incredibly expensive to do.
Really?
But if you look up on eBay, you might find one. But they are very, very expensive now.
Okay, I definitely want that as well.
It's beautifully done. The artwork is superb.
Right. Dave, here's a question I ask everybody, and I get some interesting answers. If you had a Field of Dreams wish, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
That's an interesting one. I'd go back to the guy who inspired me, Ronnie Donegan.
Yep.
The King of Skiffle.
Yep.
I got to know him very well.
Did you?
So I got up. He came and played in our folk club at the White Bear once, and I got up on stage with him somewhere else when I was heckling him from the audience. So I'd love to sit down and have more time with him.
Yeah.
He showed me his collection of tapes that he got all the songs from, the Woody Guthrie songs. And he was inspiring, and I think I'd love to renew my acquaintance with him.
Yeah, I do get Lonnie Donegan, a lot. I get Lonnie Donegan, I get Paul McCartney a lot.
I'm not sure. Paul's a wonderful songwriter.
Yeah.
I'd rather sit down with Ronnie and go through those old songs. And I was very flattered when Ronnie Donegan actually recorded one of my songs, which was wonderful.
Yeah. He was something else. Yeah, I had a long conversation about him with Petula Clark, because Petula Clark goes way back. And, everybody mentions Lonnie Donegan as, the beginning of their career is, they owe a lot to him, pretty much.
Well, I wouldn't have played the guitar if I hadn't heard Rock Island Line.
Yeah. So was that the inspiration you got for playing the guitar, pretty much?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
And having bought that, I read the interviews with him, went out and bought a Lead Belly single, then I bought a Lead Belly album.
Uh-huh, Lead Belly.
Then I began to get interested in that sort of music.
Yep.
Where it all came from.
Did you play it? Was there any album that you kind of focused in on a little bit of the blues? Or you haven't done that?
Oh, the Lead Belly album with Paul Mason Howard on Sither is absolutely wonderful. It's the best album. One of the best albums of all time.
Yeah.
It's not known that well. But I bought it when it was a 10-inch vinyl.
Mm-hmm.
But it was just the most wonderful record. As I say, look it up. It's very unusual to have Lead Belly singing with a zither player. But it's absolutely magical. It's one of the best records you'll ever buy.
I just had John Mayall on the show. And you know, we thank mainly him for bringing the blues back, you know, and thanks to the Brits for bringing it back, because it was kind of a lost art there for a while. And you know, all these guys that from the way back 50, 60 years ago, and they, you know, nobody really knew.
I don't think it would have happened if Tommy Donovan hadn't come along.
Yeah.
They wouldn't have heard about Red Belly did the rock Iron Mike.
Yeah.
And so there suddenly there's this inquisitiveness about finding out what this music was all about.
Exactly.
That inspired lots of young kids from, especially where I lived in West London. It was a sort of the River Thames Delta.
Right.
You know, so, the Eric Clapton grew up around there, Jimmy Page.
Yep.
And so they all used to go over to Pie Island. There was Jeff Beck used to go there and play the intervals like we did.
Yeah, all those guys live very close to each other, right?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah. I had a talk with Jim McCarty about that, about how close everybody lived, all these great legends, and, you know, it was like, it's just hard to imagine. Everybody was so close.
Yeah, I had breakfast with Jim McCarty about 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah.
We actually played with the Acoustic Strokes, did a show with the Yardbirds.
Yeah, I think I remember that.
Which is quite fascinating.
Yeah, you guys played with the Zombies too. They're a bunch of nice guys.
Oh, they're very sweet, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did quite a few shows with them. And the curious thing is that the front line of our band, Chas Cronk, myself, and Dave Lambert,
right,
dates back to 1974.
Right.
And I don't know of any other band, Rolling Stones, I don't care who they are, the Rolling Stones or anybody, who's got a front line of the band that's been the same since 1974.
Yeah. I can name one band.
Oh, go on then.
Golden Earring.
Oh, they're still the same.
Same guys, and they've been together since the early 60s. People don't know that. Yeah. Yeah, Golden Earring was huge back in the early 60s. And
we did shows with them in the States.
And of course, they're, you know, from Holland, from Amsterdam. But, it's a shame because those guys were. They've been around since, you know, forever, and they're with the original band, and nobody really recognizes them besides Radar Love here in the United States.
And that was a big, huge record.
Yeah, but they did a lot more than that, you know, back in the early days. And
oh, yeah. We played with them, and the only thing I can remember about them was that the highlight of their show, the drummer, stood up on his stool and jumped over his kit.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, that night he tripped over as he fell. He went smack on his face in front of the audience. We have seen some interesting things.
Oh, yeah. You guys have toured with everybody, just about. I mean, it's so many great bands. You did the... you were on the tour with... I think you played with Supertramp during Crime of the Century, too, didn't you?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, another good band. And, you know what I admire, too, is about your playing at the banjo. I always thought the banjo looks like a hard... I play some guitar, but I don't think I could master the banjo.
Well, I was the fastest banjo player in Britain.
In Britain, huh?
Yeah. I still play the banjo, but I play more gently. Not more gently, I play more melodically now. I used to be able to play Old Breakdown. In fact, I chatted to Earl Scruggs about it. We did a folk festival, and he was another one of my heroes. I said, Mr. Scruggs, I'm one of your biggest fans all the way from England. I learned to play the banjo by slowing my record player down to half speed.
Mm-hmm.
He looked at me in astonishment and said, I'm going to Dublin next week. And that was the end of our conversation.
That's funny. It looks like such a hard instrument to play. You know, I don't know. It's tough.
If I admire people now,
Yeah.
It's not just speed, it's a technique they've got. Right. It's unbelievable. And we're one of the very few bands who can go to folk festivals and headline a folk festival 1 week, which we can do in Canada. So, and then the next week we're headlining a prog rock show in the UK.
Exactly. Exactly.
So we're one of the few bands that can do that.
Yeah.
So we get to see a huge variety of music, and we're very, very fortunate.
Yeah. It's amazing. Dave, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, man.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you, and I hope your audience aren't going to be turning the radio off because it's so boring.
Oh, right? No. It's been enlightening.
Thank you very much for having us. It's been an absolute pleasure being with you.
And thank you for all the incredible music, and we're looking forward. Congratulations again on your 50 years, and we're looking forward to more dates on the tour in the U.S.
Well, it's not that far from Florida.
Yeah, that's right.
New Jersey is not that far.
That's right. Well,
a couple of hours on a plane, and that's it.
Well, eventually come to Florida.
Yeah, we will.
Thank you, Dave.
Okay, God bless you.
You too. Cheers.
Thank you again.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Purchase the latest release from The Straubs entitled The Ferryman's Curse at Amazon.com. 5 stars all the way. It's a great album. How did a working class boy from West London come to discover Sandy Denny and Rick Wakeman, work with iconic figures like David Bowie, Dick Attenborough, and Dame Vera Lynn, meet royalty, change the face of commercial radio, and be granted God's abundant blessings by the Pope? Well, find out in Dave Cousins' autobiography, Exorcising Ghost, Straub, and Other Lies. Available now at Amazon.com. For more information about David Cousins and Straubs, visit www.straubsweb.co.uk or www.straubs50.com. Very special thanks to the great Billy James of Glass Onion PR for arranging this interview with David Cousins, and of course, the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsom of BBS Radio for making the magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com, and please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. Also, don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of a Neglected American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, available now at Amazon.com. You will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com. Specializing in author and music artist publicity plans, we shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.